Africa and the Amazon have been explored, but the imaginal realm? That's a road eternally ours for the taking. Part 2 with Stephen Harrod Buhner, author of Plant Intelligence and the Imaginal Realm, Into the Dreaming of Earth. It's a great journey. Stay tuned. I'm Robin Clare, and this is Tributaries. I'm not going to live forever. You aren't. And as you comically noted in an interview I heard with you, that if Bob Dylan and Gandhi are going to be taken, they're certainly not going to hold on to me.
So. Yeah, I know. It's like you look at it, you're like, you know, these incredible people all through history. You know, look, if Einstein died of old age, I mean, what chance do the rest of us have? You know, Bob Dylan got old. What chance do the rest of us have?
Yeah.
You know, so we have to begin looking at, and that's one of the real insanities in the Western culture, our fear of personal biodegrading.
Right.
You know, we're meant to biodegrade.
And to
we're
take
biodegrading
that on.
Right now as we speak.
Yeah.
And it's important. Death is built into the system, and it's really our terror of that underneath, unrecognized, that's driving a huge number of our responses to the circumstances we're in now.
Yes, and that's one thing I wanted to ask you your feelings about, because as we mentioned earlier, it's a jungle out there. The plants, what they've done to survive and, you know, and to live and to love is just so beautiful and amazing and part of just such an amazing system. And do they live in fear? Are they growing and living and loving out of a constant state of fear in the literal physical jungle?
Well, that's, see, one of the interesting things is that as I've grown older and begin to get the perspective that age and living a long time gives a person, the thing is, no matter where you go, whether you're in the liberal world, the conservative world, the scientific world, it doesn't matter. It turns out that over time, the most extreme members of whatever group it is begin to take over that area, and they begin to control the conversation. And that's one of the things that we've constantly experienced with neo-Darwinism. Now, Darwin was very different than his followers present him to be, and his
did
his
that
beliefs,
happen with Jesus?
his beliefs, his understandings were very different, and he did not look at life as an unremitting struggle for survival in the way that we're constantly taught that he did. It turns out that cooperation is much more fundamental in the ecological world than that so-called struggle for survival. The struggle for survival dynamic is different. The way it really works is every self-organized system has a drive to protect its structural integrity, okay? Because it's here, that's where what we kind of refer to not very clearly as the ego comes into being. It's a specific sort of consciousness module that occurs when neural nets form, and its sort of structural function is to help the organism remain intact. And so what happens is when, you know, some threat to our organizational integrity occurs, we experience fear. Well, the thing is, every self-organized system experiences that. It's a message. It's like the indicator on your gas tank in your car. It's just simply information that you need to attend to your environment and whatever is flowing toward you, whatever's happening in that moment. But unless there's a specific dynamic like that that forces you to turn your attention to it, most of the time, most organisms are living in a level of high cooperation and collaboration. There's a genuine caring that flows through the earth that's absolutely fundamental to its nature. And so, yeah, plants are afraid, but they don't spend all their time crouching over their can of pork and beans with a 30-06. trying to protect, you know, their territory so they're not going to die. It's not
right, it's
like
another
that. And I quote Richard Lewontin in there. He's a Harvard zoologist. He's great. He says, you know, to think that everything is inimical and hostile to life, that's a form of psychosis. It's not the way the world works.
Right. And so there's another word for that. You know, humans have encompassed it in fear, but there's another word there. It's a cooperation with that unknown that's saying, you better go to a gas station right now.
Right. And you turn your attention to it. But the thing is, we're all going to die, and there's one thing Gaia understands. It's dying. It's people and organisms, life forms have been dying here for billions of years. It's not a thing to be terrified of the way we are. It's just part of the warp and the weave.
Yeah, it's like the word anxious. Quite a while ago now, it just struck me as, you know, maybe anxious isn't really anxious. Maybe what I'm feeling is there's a shift about.
That's a great insight. I mean, it's like when you begin to feel anxious, it's information
that I'm not conscious of yet.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so that's why contemplation is so important. So you turn away from what you're doing and you begin to sit in contemplation with the anxiousness. And you'll find that it's either being generated because of some destabilization in your internal world or something's happening in the external world that you need to attend to. And there's a part that you've put into your unconscious that's the only way it knows to get your attention.
Yeah. Well, there's relating a little bit back a few minutes ago, with all things, there is a point of spontaneous synchronicity that shows itself in many ways. And, you know, there are some that hold, well, humans will spontaneously synchronize in full-on consciousness, peace and love, brother. But I think it's more like what you were saying. There is a certain amount of that is going to go on. But to think, you know, all the devilish, evilly kind of deeds that are going on in the world are going to vanish.
That's just another kind of utopian power fantasy.
Yeah.
Not that different than science, you know, that stuff about science is going to allow us to live to be a billion years old or whatever their story is. The thing is that human beings really haven't changed very much in the last 35,000 years or million years or however long you want to extend that timeline, and they're not going to change very much. I mean, there's things that can be done to minimize what people consider the negative attributes of Homo sapien, but nevertheless, Homo sapien is Homo sapien, and so that the dynamic is the most important thing is we can individually choose to become aware. We can individually choose to do what we're going to do with our own life, but trying to come up with one sort of top-down systematic way that everybody on Earth has to be in order to be peaceful, it's a totalitarian framework that's actually quite frightening.
Yes.
And if you look deeper, what you really see is you see a tremendously broad variety of innovation amongst the human species. In other words, their sensory gating channels run across a huge range. And what you begin to see in the human species is not so much physical alteration, but you begin to see some extent of behavioral innovation and alteration that under tremendous stress, the species begins to alter its DNA to a certain extent. But this is true of every organism on Earth. We're not special this way.
Of course.
And you begin to see the emergence of people who begin to think in a different way and begin to find solutions outside the habituated patterns that we've known. And I think the awareness that dynamic is ongoing and occurs, some people then begin to generalize, well, that's going to happen to every human being on the planet, you know, so that we all live in peace. And that's basically, it's much too simplistic. Gaia doesn't actually really care if people die or not.
Right.
Gaia loves everything, but Gaia's not afraid of death or pain, really.
Yeah. Well, as you're speaking, of course, what came to mind were antibiotics and how the bacteria goes, oh, okay, well, let's do this now.
Basically by us creating and releasing into the ecosystem millions upon millions of pounds of antibiotics over the last 60 years, you know, it stimulated these massive changes in the bacterial underpinnings of the planet. And the reason why, I mean, it's the perfect example of the problems with 19th century thinking, in that they looked at human beings as the only intelligent actors moving across a static backdrop, and that bacteria were really stupid, and therefore we could create this stuff because we're so clever, and then we could defeat all disease, and then we would live to be, you know, a million years old or a billion years old or whatever they're into that year. And the thing is that by not understanding that bacteria are highly intelligent, but more, it's more than that, that the genome is a highly flexible organ of a cell that can change under impetus from the organism and the environment itself to produce new form and behavior in really short periods of time. So we created this tremendous pressure in the ecosystem, and the bacteria began to cooperatively work together to defeat the impact of those antibiotics, because the whole earth rests on that bacterial membrane. We're all expressed out of that. In fact, we're all just forms of bacteria and more sophisticated gyrations, I guess. And so they've had to change, and we are looking at, within the next 25 years or so, pretty much the complete failure of antibiotics, and there's nothing that we can do about it.
Right. It leads right into this quote that I wanted to talk a little bit about from Bucky Fuller. It's possible to get out of a place, impossible to get out of a scenario. And so,
and
that comes to mind,
you know,
yeah.
And it's whether it's him or Gregory Bateson or Masanobu Fukuoka, people understood that we're not in a place. There is no beginning and no end here. We're in a scenario that you cannot get out of. And they really grasped the quantum nature of the place in which we're in. I mean, it's hard not to fall back on using the word place, but in this scenario, this constantly moving, altering scenario, and it, once you grasp that, it changes everything.
I know. It's like, any bad relationships come to mind, you know, it's like, oh, I'm leaving him or her, and then the same thing happens over again. And it's
right, because we carry certain meanings with us.
Yeah.
Unexamined, those meanings generate certain responses from the world around us.
So you talk quite a bit in your book about the metaphysical backdrop. And, you know, that can be interpreted as the fabric. I'm wondering, using that and sort of as the place you're consciously trying to be with, without all of the extra noise or whatever else you want to call it that we fill our lives with, you actually give some ways in your book to make it a point to get there, to contact there, or make conscious contact there, maybe.
Right, and, you know, I was just reading this marvelous new book that's not out yet, actually, by this woman named Amy Fusselman, called Savage Places. And she makes this great comment in there. I wish I'd read the book earlier so I could have stolen it and put it in my book. She said, very few of us are aware of the atmosphere of a place. Yes, we're aware often of the atmosphere of a restaurant, but we aren't often aware that space, one of the integral aspects of all space is atmosphere. We just look at space as the distance between here and where we're going, but we're not aware of the quality of the space that we move through. And so she taps into the same thing I was talking about, but from her own unique linguistics, which I just really adored. The thing is that it's our feeling sense that's the most crucial way to tap into the metaphysical background of the world. And I quote the Kalahari Bushmen a fair amount in this book as well. They said, you know, every human being must wake up twice in the morning. They must wake up and get out of bed, and then they must awaken their heart. And then they would say, human beings, as they grow, have to develop a library of feelings, because everything that they encounter has a feeling quality to it, including the space that they're moving through. so that dynamic, reclaiming the feeling sense, is really the crucial sort of little entryway into everything else, the metaphysical background of the world, the different kind of thinking that's really necessary to get out of the sort of troubles that we're in, to be able to open gating channels more further. And it's a habituated pattern. Children naturally do it, but we get trained out of it, and to reclaim it is somewhat difficult. But it's like literally with everything then you encounter, you go, how does this doorway feel? How does this restaurant feel? How does this person feel? How does this hospital feel? How does this pill feel that they gave me to take? How does everything feel? How does this conversation feel? How does this word that I've heard feel to me? And as you begin to reclaim that feeling sense, you naturally begin to move more and more deeply into the metaphysical background of the world, and you begin to reclaim all of these sensibilities and capacities that are inherent in the human being, but yet that have been so suppressed in us that we really wander around only just kind of a shadow of ourselves.
Right. A little alarm goes off for me hearing what you're saying. I get it. And I wonder if also it's if you start going into, or not you, but someone starts going into the feeling sense, it seems like that could possibly really hang somebody up and, you know, get them lost in all emotion, for instance.
Well, emotion is really different than feeling. So when you have a feeling, you know, you go into a restaurant and it feels warm and nurturing and stuff. And so the feeling, the emotion that's going to be generated is going to be something more like a joy or a comfortability and, you know, happy feeling. If you go into one that's really bleak and existentially despairing, then maybe the emotional response you'll have to the feeling is going to be fear. So your emotional response to the feeling gives you information about the feeling. But the feeling itself, it's a sixth perceptual sense that all of us have, but that only the people in the Western cultures have denied has any legitimacy. So it's beginning to use this sensory capacity that we're all born with, but that has become tremendously atrophied over time. And very much for people that begin to reclaim that, they are in the position of an explorer going up the Amazon, because they begin moving into territory that they have very little map for, very little cultural support for, and it's easy to run into things that are frightening because you're actually, as James Hillman put it, you're reclaiming the response of the heart to what is presented to the senses. And the world you begin to find there is the real world, and it's very different than the world that we've been taught by our culture and our schooling is out there. It's not even remotely the same thing.
Right, which the next point to make here is that quote about the Amazon that you have in your book, that just because you go down the Amazon and you might get lost does not mean that there has to be a law now that says you can't go down the Amazon and get lost,
right.
Which is a natural response.
That's one of the big things going on in our culture in the United States,
yes.
And in the UK even more so, which is strange. But people are so terrified of the loss of safety that our whole culture is beginning to orient around it as if all of us were born and meant to never experience any adverse events at all. So, I mean, one of the things I talk about in there is the function of psychotropics in the ecosystem. And their primary function is they affect every neural network on the planet identically, whether it's a spider or a plant or a human being. They open sensory gating channels very widely so you can encounter the metaphysical background of the world. You can access meanings that you normally don't perceive, and then you can generate behaviors out of the meanings you perceive that are outside of your normal habituated processes, and that allows tremendous innovation in living organisms to respond to environmental perturbations. So, you know, they've been around for hundreds of millions of years, and they fulfill a very specific function.
Yes.
So one of the reasons they're illegal is because they say, oh, well, if you really read all the material, which I did, they basically say, look, they change people, the boundary between them and other life forms thins. They start to act differently. They think differently. And, you know, and some people, you know, get lost and then, you know, their lives are ruined. So therefore, we have to prohibit them. And
my
point is, we're all explorers. And just because some people get lost doesn't mean we should be prohibited from exploring.
Yes. And interestingly enough, I have a friend living on a certain island where they were helping to grow the ayahuasca plants, and they are taking over.
and that's a thing
invasive.
You begin to see. Like, for instance, I talk about psilocybin in there, how psilocybin tends to move into grassland ecozones that have been overgrazed. They get very forceful about moving in there even more strongly.
Yeah. Well, you very wisely mention that seeking protection for the journey is not the right, I don't want to get into right and what's wrong, but if that's the orientation, then that's the orientation that wants to be broadened or shifted overall, of course.
It's not very functional
to
look at it that way. What if we accept that we're going to be harmed? I mean, it basically, you know, it's like trying to get all kids that are learning skateboards to dress in some sort of suit of armor so that they never get hurt. That's sort of where we're going. But the thing is, it's important. You know, there's that thing where they say, you know, if we crawl around in the dirt, our immune system becomes a lot more healthy. And it's because we haven't been being exposed to dirt so much that immune function is falling a lot in the United States.
Right.
The same thing is true in the psychological and psychic realm. We have to be able to crawl around in the dirt, and then we begin to learn how to take care of ourselves. We begin to learn a whole lot of things that we can't learn if our, you know, emotional world is kept chaste and safe. And we become, you know, these innovative, strong human beings, and we begin to find solutions to problems that can only be found if they're encountered.
Yes, exactly, yes. And if we don't encounter them, then there we are again. We're the surface being.
And so many children are being trained now to remain children very late in life. I mean, I see stories all the time of parents who are filling out their children's college exams, going to the
right.
college intake queries with them, or even their jobs. You know, there's something really screwy about this.
Something, yes. This question is a whole other interview, so maybe just a sentence or something, but you mentioned toward the end of your book that moving into the places that you move into is difficult in many, many ways. And I'm wondering what support you found and does the plant world offer you? Nutritionally, I know physically, nutritionally, it can be depleting.
It can be, but one of the things that I talk about a lot in there is that when we get away from this software program we've been given, that we're the only intelligent, ensouled, aware life form on the earth, when we get everything is ensouled around us. Everything is aware, intelligent. Everything has language as sophisticated as our own. It's just different in nature. Everything is communicating and interactive with us. What begins to happen is that you begin to move into the world itself, one ensouled phenomenon amongst many, and you become a part of this community in which you're never alone in that kind of way that human beings in the West now are so desperately trapped in this sort of solitary. I mean, Bly put it great. He said, you know, human beings are now trapped in their own houses, and they look out at their windows at a world with which they have no meaningful connection. And it's leaving that house. And that sense of being constantly companioned by caring beings, it changes everything. That and the constant attention. I mean, one of the things I talk about a lot is we're multiple personalities. We're not a single consciousness. And there's a lot of data in the book about that. But we all have parts of us that we get in arguments with. But it's learning to make friends with those parts of ourselves, especially the very young parts of ourselves that are still embedded within us, like the rings are embedded in a tree of prior years of growth. And those parts serve particular ecological functions within us and in the world. And when you don't abandon yourself or yourselves, and you are in good relationship with your own internal family and the external family of the world, what you get then is massive resources enabling you to deal with anything that you might encounter out there in the world. I mean, there literally is no limit.
Agreed, yes. Yeah. Well, Stephen, I don't know if I want to be the one to tell you this, and I'm not sure if you've been warned or not, but the end of your book feels suspiciously like a beginning.
What part of the end of the book?
Well, just at the closer I got to the last pages of your book, I thought he might think he's written this 500-page book, which, by the way, everyone, I recommend every single page of it. It seemed like it was going toward a wrap-up, but in the wrap-up, there's an unraveling. So I just thought there's more to come.
Unfortunately, authorial bloat is my middle name. And even though I'm thinking, you know, I'm not sure that I'm going to write any more books along this sort of theme, you know, I lay around at night and I constantly think of new stuff. That every book seems to have as many questions in it as it does answers.
And that's the beauty of them, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I want to also tell you, I formulated the T-shirt for your book.
You did?
Yeah, and it's for children. And what it says on the front is, I'm a Gaian expression.
Ooh, that's very nice. Ooh, I like that.
So we'll offer them in pink and blue.
Pink and blue. Yeah, but, you know, maybe rainbow. Yeah.
Stephen Buhner, wonderful author and explorer. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.